There's a church in Arkansas that has impressed me so much. I saw it on my first stop on our sabbatical pilgrimage this past summer. We ended up over the course of the summer in several national parks, some of the most stunning country and coastline our beautiful nation offers, from Maine to Washington, from sea to sea. But our first stop on our first day was a little church in the woods of Arkansas, made almost entirely of glass. Not just a few windows, but the whole structure, the walls, the ceiling, everything. Clear glass, supported by wood posts and trusses. And this little church was surrounded by tall trees and dappled light and changing weather. I don't know how they built it. I don't know how they maintain it. All I know is those few minutes in that space became the lens through which I saw everything else that summer. Amazing. A church whose worshiping life is lived out, surrounded by God's creation. A congregation whose spirituality is shaped by the beauty and the challenges of the natural world. What a gift that would be. I think Isaiah would have affirmed such a church as he shares God's stunning promises. "For I am about to create a new heavens and a new earth, and you're going to be part of it. Not just part of it, you're going to be central to it. I'm doing this for you, and I'm doing this with you. I'm doing this, a new heavens and a new earth. You're invited to join me and your brothers and sisters, wolves and lambs lying together, in realizing the redemptive dream for all creation, living in shalom, in peace." This is the exuberant message of Isaiah 65. Lift up your heads, lift up your hearts. We have work to do. Good work. Work that matters. Work that will last and will bless the lives of the old and the young. Lives of your generation and the ones to come and the nations of the world for a long, long time to come. With this poetic prophecy, we come full circle from the creation and its fall in Genesis to its recreation. Here we see poetry of the dawn of hope. And God knows we need it. This is the kind of word we need when it seems like the world is falling apart. We face serious challenges today that can seem like the world is doomed. So did they, certainly, so did they. Those folks back then lived through dark, desperate times, those ancient Israelites. In 586 BC, Jerusalem was sacked by the Babylonian armies, which then marched the inhabitants of Jerusalem across the desert to Babylon, where they were exiled for over 70 years. The biblical prophets weren't particularly sympathetic as all of this unfolded. "It's your own fault," they would tell them over and over again. "It's your own fault that this is happening. You didn't live in the way of God. You didn't live in justice or in mercy with your neighbor. You didn't respect the land and your place in it. You carved idols out of wood and stone and made yourself gods, and this is the result." Jeremiah, Isaiah, Amos, the prophets, these were not comforting counselors much of the time. They gave searing words of indictment with clear-eyed truth-telling. "Brothers and sisters," they said, "you got yourself into this mess." The Bible has a startling way of telling uncomfortable truth, believing that people need the truth and that they're actually capable of hearing it. There's not a lot of sugar sometimes in the spoonful of medicine that the disciples prescribe. And as their exile began, the prophet said to them, "You will hear some people say, 'Peace, peace,' but there is no peace. There is hope, but for now, the night will grow darker before there's a new dawn." The Jerusalem they were forced to walk away from was devastated. The temple torn down, walls in crumbles, vineyards trampled, crops withering in the field. Their lives were ruined. That's what everyone would say. Our lives are ruined. How can we sing the Lord's song by the waters of Babylon? They lamented. Eventually, they were set free from their Babylonian captivity. Returning to Jerusalem, their hopes were high for what they would encounter, but their troubles were far from over. The city was in ruins, the temple needing to be rebuilt, the walls of the city down, vineyards trampled, and they had few resources available to them to tackle the problem that was in front of them. They had to summon courage and creativity to go forward in the face of despair. The problem was too big for any single person, even too big for all of them together. They needed divine intervention and they needed uncommon personal resolve. They needed to believe that there could be a new heavens and a new earth to emerge from the one they were staring at. From where will my help come? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. It would take uncommon faith and uncommon resolve to see them through the challenges they faced. You see the picture that they faced when this prophecy of hope was given to them. You can understand how fully they needed to hear such a word, even from the one who had already told them the truth of the darkness they would face. They needed to hear the truth of light in the darkness. Now, it seems to me we're facing in this era a similarly enormous, heaven and earth sized, too big to handle challenge, in the face of which any single individual feels hopelessly, virtually helpless. For all the problems we may face as individuals, and we do, and for all the problems particular to any given community, and there are, we're bound together by an even greater challenge in this time. Even the carnival going on in Washington, D.C. politics, no matter how it turns out, is a mere distraction from the larger issues facing heaven and earth. This century will be remembered far beyond whoever sits in the Oval Office for 3 or 4 or 8 years. It's the climate situation. And if it weren't clear before us, it should be by now. Embedded in a 500-page U.S. federal government environmental impact statement from earlier this fall was articulation of an assumption that the planet on its current course will warm by the end of this century far beyond what we've been hearing to this point. Until now, the thought has been that if we do all the right things, all together, we can keep global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit. Over pre-industrial levels. And if we do that, then we can arrest and hopefully turn back on the clock on the problems this will inevitably bring about. But the situation seems even more dire than we thought. Embedded in a Trump administration report from this fall, which, to emphasize, a Trump administration report, Al Gore's fingers are nowhere near this report. The projection that average global temperatures will increase not just by 3 to 4 degrees, but by 7 degrees by 2100. And that this is by now virtually inevitable. 7 degrees warming. And that's not even the most dire projection that's out there. Now, to be fair, no one knows for sure what's going to happen. These are complex computer models based on incomplete data and projection of future climate science and future human behavior. No one knows for sure. And yet, if this is remotely true, we're in the beginning of a global crisis that ought to shake our attention. The life of every person on earth will be changed, especially the poor and the vulnerable. And the life of every creature on earth will be altered. Few living creatures can adapt quickly enough to the kind of change we're beginning to see take shape. And all compounding the problem is this: who's to blame for this under the heavens and on the earth? All the science and common sense point to human activity post-industrial revolution. That seems incontrovertible. But that still leaves open the question: who's to blame? Are governments to blame? They do set policies and can tip the scales on market economies and energy sourcing and treatment of public land. Some governments and administrations do a better job than others. The current Brazilian government seems to be content to let the rainforest be cleared and burned by companies who want to grow soybeans. Are oil companies to blame? Or coal companies? Should we blame them for extracting from deep within the earth the sources of energy that make our modern life flow? What about pollution from emerging economies like India and China, where millions of people are being lifted from abject poverty? Or fishermen who overfish the seas? Or timber mills who bring down old growth forests? There are almost 8 billion people on the earth now. Who of them is to be held responsible for the changing global climate, the effects of which will change our common home? We all are. I'm reminded of G.K. Chesterton's response to the newspaper which asked, "What's wrong with the world?" "Dear sirs," he replied, "I am." So, I wonder, what would the prophets say if one of them were here? I think it would be something like this: "Brothers and sisters, you've done this to yourself. You were given the vocation by your Creator of serving and protecting the earth like a gardener tending her garden. You were established as a priest of all creation, delivering the goods of this bounty in praise to God. But instead of serving the world, you put yourself over and above it. You beat your plows into refineries and your pruning hooks into tractor trailers, and you stopped looking at the world as gift and started looking at it only as resource. And then you called it stewardship when you took anything you wanted because you said you needed it. The land was a gift and you trampled it. The heavens were a blessing and you dirtied them. Death by a thousand cuts, that's the world's bleeding wounds. Who did it? You did it. Even though most of the time you didn't even know what you were doing. You or your fathers and mothers or their fathers and mothers before them. You didn't intend harm, but it was easy to be comfortable with your machines and your technologies that made possible your way of life. And so then you wanted the next thing and then the next thing after that. And now the world is consumed with the need of people to consume more food, more exhaust, more pavement, more woods from forest. As a people, a whole people, you are living beyond what the world can sustain. That's what she's telling you. The earth cannot sustain this number of people consuming resources at this rate to support the industrial lifestyle that's been normalized. this isn't working. And the cost for pretending like it will continue to work will be measured not just in a few degrees, but in dead reefs, melted glaciers, dirtied air, flooded coastal cities, extinct species. This is what it looks like to remake the heavens and earth in your own image. I don't know how welcome the prophet's message would be. The prophets did not pull punches. They had a way of seeing the truth and speaking it, as hard as it could be to hear. Jesus, too, had a prophetic strain within him, didn't he? He believed people needed to hear the truth. He told them what they could hardly wrap their minds around, saying things like, "I'm going to be arrested and tried and crucified, and after 3 days rise again." Not just that, he said to them, a generation before Rome sacked Jerusalem, this beautiful temple that you're looking up at, this beautiful temple, it's coming down all the way to the ground. Not one stone will be left on another. He told them all of this clearly. Christian faith has an enormous, underappreciated capacity to look reality in the eye, even if we weep, to mourn, and then to rise again. After telling the people they got themselves into the mess they're in, Isaiah isn't done with them. Isaiah 65 is a ray of light in the darkest of places. You have hope. No matter how despairing things look, we always have hope. To a people in despair, Isaiah insisted, you must have hope and keep striving for what seems impossible to you in your own strength, because in God's strength, anything is possible. Of all people in the world, Christians are equipped to look at daunting situations with clear eyes and to lean forward. This is the essence of Christian spirituality. We are a people made by stories of slavery and exodus, of exile and return, of death and resurrection, of darkness and light, martyrdom and witness. We are exactly the world's hope for hope, even in the century to come. And that may sound strange. Christians haven't exactly been on the front lines of raising the alarms about a changing climate. But we can be, because we are equipped spiritually with the two things most needed in times of despairing crisis: hope and meaning. My friend Kyle Childress is a good pastor. He shares a story from Jim Wallace about volunteering in a church homeless shelter around Christmas time. Jim says the church basement was decorated with banners and Christmas decorations. One of the men who lived each day out on the streets looked around that room and asked out loud, "What is the good news anyway?" Jim said there was a long pause. No one knew what to say. Finally, someone spoke up from the back of the line, says, "The good news is it doesn't have to be like this." Kyle's church in Nacogdoches has over the years been courageous witness to the gospel in all kinds of ways. Kyle continues by saying, "Any church that stops leaning toward the new heavens and the new earth, any church which no longer keeps taut the tension between the way the world is and the world as God intends it to be, is a sadly compromised and accommodated church. We've somehow got to keep before us the gap between the bad news or no news and the good news. There is some distance between God's will for the world and the world in which we now live. There is stress between what is and what ought to be. We have hope that keeps us striving forward, even when we don't know how in the world hope can be realized. We do have hope. we also have meaning. We're taught that what we do with our lives has eternal consequences and meaning for us and our children and our neighbors. There can be situations when the calculus is nothing I do matters, so why do anything at all? This is absolutely the reasoning we face concerning ecological issues. In the government report I mentioned, they used exactly the same logic. It was a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration report written to justify President Trump's decision to freeze federal fuel efficiency standards for cars and light trucks built after 2020. While the proposal would increase greenhouse gas emissions, the impact statement says that that policy would add just a very small drop to a very big hot bucket. So you see the logic? Because the problem is too big for any one thing to solve, we don't see the value in doing the one thing. It's a policy of despair, not hope or meaning. But it's not a partisan policy. It's human nature. It's the predicament we're in. It's logic on a national scale, which is negotiated in every household every day. I could change my whole existence. I could produce zero carbon emissions by walking everywhere, eating only from my garden, turning off my air conditioner, and at the end of the day, it will change essentially nothing. We could do it all as a congregation, or even a city, or a state, though that might begin to move things. But even then, little would change. And so the question is, why pay the extra cost? We all face these decisions all the time. What car to buy, whether to pay a little more for farmers market broccoli. The decisions are woven through every aspect of our lives. Now, Christians do the same math as everybody else. Is the juice worth the squeeze? These are complicated decisions played out every day in everyone's lives. We cannot extract ourselves from the complications that our lives are enmeshed in a global economy. We just are here. But standing here, we are still people who believe one person's life can make all the difference. We are people constituted to believe one death can change the world. Of course we are. One person's life, one death can change the world. This is who we are. We are no other. As Jesus people, you can't squeeze that conviction out of us. What that means is that we are somehow not overwhelmed. We're able to find meaning in even the smallest action. Even when it seems like it might not make a global difference, we are able to delight in the goodness of participating in God's redemption, even in the smallest of ways. Actually, it all starts right there. That's what's been lost. That's what we can help the world recover. Delight in this world that we've been given. It starts right there. A people who start there just might change the world for better. And so somewhere there's a young man planting a flower garden in a backyard to give bees nectar. And there's an older couple shopping at the hipster farmer's market, meeting a local farmer. There's someone sharing a ride, just one simple ride across town. And there's the Bamberger Ranch, restoring 2,500 acres of Central Texas land. And there's the Creech Farm, restoring old natural Texas prairie. There's someone making small decisions to save a little electricity, and there's someone putting a solar panel on their house. There's someone with their hands in the soil planting tomato plants, and there's someone committing to eating all locally sourced produce. There's someone taking time to watch a sunrise and pray instead of rushing frantic headlong into another day. And there's someone writing representatives about protecting wilderness areas. There's someone visiting a national park and being overcome by God's glory in nature's temples. And there's someone planting an oak in their yard they'll never see fully grown. And there's a church worshiping through glass windows with their eyes wide open to the world around them. We have hope. We have meaning, and the world is going to need a lot of both in the years to come. The world is going to need a church wide open to the world with all its challenges and all its beauty, its changing seasons and its changing climates, its troubles and its hope for renewal. The world is going to need a people who can lead a consumptive, despairing generation to live in delight and in hope with meaning for the beauty of and the renewal of the earth. Amen.